Investing Simplified is brought to you by Chuck Price, President and Wealth Manager of Price Financial Group, Wealth Management Incorporated, a registered investment advisor firm. Individual situations will vary, and the information on this show should only be relied upon when coordinated with individual advice. Other parties present on this broadcast are not affiliated with Price Financial Group Wealth Management. Chuck can be contacted by visiting www.pfgwm.com. You can email Chuck a question at askchuck@pfgwm.com, or you can call him right now at 503-417-7626. That's 503-417-7626. Now, here's the host of Investing Simplified, Chuck Price.
We do Investing Simplified.
Well, welcome to another great Saturday morning. We've got a special guest today, Harry S. Dent Jr., Senior Editor of Economic and Economy and Markets. And in studio with me is Carl Jepson with the Warren Allen Law Firm.
Good morning, Chuck.
And Kevin Stege with the Baker Coastal CPA Firm.
Good morning.
And we're going to get right into and talk to Harry Dent. Harry Dent is the author of The Demographic Cliff. And I have to tell you, if you haven't bought this book, you need to go on Amazon and get this book. And if you don't subscribe to Harry's newsletter, you can sign up for it free on my website, pfgwm.com, or you can go to Harry's site at hsdent.com and sign up for it. He has a wealth of information. And Harry, are you on the line?
Hey, by the way, it's hsdent.com to get that free newsletter.
Okay, great. And listen, you got we also have it on our website. You can sign up for it and get it as well. And I highly recommend it. You know, I'm going to get right into it because there's a lot of things going on in the economy. And Harry, we're just really happy you're spending Saturday morning with us here. But one of the questions I have to ask you, you know, you've been talking about deflation for years. And everybody on all the business networks have been boo-hooing that and saying, no, 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 we're going to have hyperinflation. Dent doesn't know what he's talking about. But boy, is it coming out now that you nailed that.
Well, we've been saying gold's going to fall, oil's going to drop, and people say, no, it can't. You know, the emerging market demand. Hey, emerging markets are underperforming. They're slowing. They're suffering from falling commodity prices because world growth is falling, and they're commodity exporters. So we've been saying that as well, that there's a vicious cycle where emerging markets slow, following commodity prices going down, and then China's export machine slows down, because they export over 50% to emerging countries, and then they're the biggest purchaser of industrial commodities and energy in the world, so then that drives commodity prices down. So this is also happening, and all these idiots on CNBC that say, oh, falling oil prices are good for the economy, consumers and businesses, well, they obviously are in some ways, but we have a fracking bubble that everybody thinks it's a technology wonder. It's not. It's just another bubble fueled by super cheap high-yield debt. At 5% rates. I mean, it's typically 8 to 10% for that sort of risky sort of debt. But, you know, when these companies can borrow that cheap, they can produce oil and natural gas and compete on global markets and domestically because of this cheap money. But when oil falls, it no longer works. You're going to see, I think this is the trigger for the next debt crisis, much like the subprime crisis was before. That was just 20%. Of mortgages, well, these fracking and energy high-yield bonds are about 18% of the high-yield debt bubble that has swelled up in the last 5 years. So I think we got another bubble getting ready to burst, and the stock market is just looking like, hey, no problem. You know, this market is going to crash worse than anybody thinks.
You know, speaking about that, I wonder then, Harry, Are all the real estate investment trusts that have been put into the oil industry of late for this to help fund this, are they going to have the same problem we had years ago with the real estate investment trust where they basically collapsed?
Yeah. I mean, you have a lot, you know, tied to this. You got high yield bond investors going to get hit. There's leveraged loans, $300 billion to these energy companies, these real estate investment trusts are putting in money, they're going to get hurt. I mean, this thing, that's why all it takes is a trigger to cause a global debt crisis, but that can only happen when you have debt way out of balance. And like just in case for the U.S., you know, we now, you know, we had, I think it was like $53 trillion in total debt at the top of the last bubble. You know, now we got 60-some trillion. We got more than ever. So debt ratios are only going up in the world because governments are stimulating lending through low interest rates. Governments are running huge deficits around the world. So we're just more leveraged, more ready for a bigger fall when something triggers it. And I thought it was going to be Southern Europe and Germany with such weak demographics ahead like Japan in the 90s. But it looks like the actual trigger could be falling oil prices that basically kill the frackers. Fracking is done. Fracking only works at high oil prices and cheap debt, neither of which is sustainable. So it's not a technology revolution long term, as we've been told, in a great new way for us to become energy independent. It's just a bubble.
Well, one of the concerns I've had is one of the things we've talked about for with you on the air for well over a year now is about the fact that that possibly one of the countries in Europe could start this whole worldwide recession or depression. But one of the things that really concerns me is what's going on with Russia, because they are in deep trouble financially.
Deep trouble. I mean, they were already in trouble because Putin made this aggressive move and they got sanctions slapped on them. Well, that would have been only so bad if oil prices hadn't collapsed, which had, you know, little or nothing to do with that. Oil prices collapse for the same reason everything collapsed. You get overproduction. This fracking created 2 to 3 million extra barrels per day at a time when global growth has been slowing for years. If you look at global growth, it's just gone like from 5% to 4% to 3%. You know, China keeps slowing every year from 9 to 8 to 7.5. The forecast for the best model we've seen says it's going to go down to 4 to 5% in the next year. So this slowing of growth continues, and you have overproduction. So oil prices are not done. We've said from the beginning, 2 to 3 years ago, Chuck, that oil is going to fall ultimately to $10 to $20 a barrel, and I think it's going to hit the back to the lows in 2008, probably in the next year. I think oil is going to probably bounce from here at some point, maybe back into the 70s, and then it's going to collapse again, and next thing you know, it's going to be more like $32 a barrel. At that, there will be no question that fracking is done for good, and there'll be no question that a lot of these bonds and debt will default, and I think that's what's going to start the next crisis, because as soon as some loans go bad and some debt goes bad, then bondholders start scrutinizing everything. Interest rates across the board for all types of debt, government treasuries to high-yield junk bonds and everything else, is way lower than normal because governments have pushed interest rates down to zero short-term and zero long-term when you adjust for, say, the roughly 2% inflation rate. So free money causes malinvestment, and then that investment basically goes bad. That's how bubbles burst. And so oil is bursting from its own high prices, its own overproduction, stimulated by all this cheap money. And now it's bursting, and it's going to keep bursting. Here's one of the things people don't understand. Most frackers are only profitable between $55 at best and $85 at worst. And so they're already unprofitable, and they're going to stop investing. But their variable cost, once they've discovered the oil or gas, is much lower, like $10 to $20 a barrel. So until these wells peak out in the next year or two, and they only last for 2 years, they're going to keep producing more. And from these wells, and the demand is going to keep going down. So I see oil prices crashing in the next year. So I do think we're going to be at $32 before we know it. And that's going to trigger a stock market crash, I think.
Well, one other thing I want to ask you about, and this is a little bit off the subject about the economy, but one of the great things for the Northwest is your Irrational Summit is coming. Irrational Economic Summit is coming here in 2015, September 10th to 12th. It's going to be in Vancouver, B.C. And for anybody out there who is a investor of your own or you're working with a financial planner, you don't want to miss those days with Harry and the gifts that he has at this economic summit, because they are fantastic. I am really looking forward. I've already booked my time there, and I am looking forward to that meeting here in the Great Northwest.
Yeah, you know, Chuck, also, we had David Stockman in our last conference in Miami. He got a standing ovation. He's one of the smartest guys in the country right now. we're going to beam him. He can't make it travel-wise. We're going to beam him in, and we're also going to have Lacey Hunt, who's one of the few traditional economists that really understands inflation and deflation and debt bubbles, and we've had him speak before, and he's like, we call it the voice of God. So we're going to have some really good speakers there as well.
Yeah, Lacey Hunt is terrific. I signed up for his newsletter when he was at your Irrational Economic Summit in California, and that guy was great.
Yeah, he is.
He is really great.
Well, we're going to have the two best economists other than me at this conference.
Well, Harry, I was this is Carl Jepsen. I was curious about this oil thing because I've been a little bit alarmed by what we see in Russia and here too with the fracking and all that stuff. So let's assume that it does crash, you know, and the fracking thing kind of disappears because they can't make any money doing it. How long do you think it would take for that? What effect would that have on the oil prices? I mean, how long would it take for the oil industry to get back to where they were you know, so that you end up with $4 a gallon gasoline? I mean, does it take years for that to happen once it crashes like that?
You know, I don't think you're going to get back that high, but I think it'll only take about a year. These fracking wells last about 2 years. So the existing wells, let's say on average, maybe have a year to go because they're going to be spread from 0 to 2 years. So I'd say by the end of 2015, early 2016, this supply is going to contract from this low variable cost, and then that's going to help prices go back up. But at the same time, I think the world's going to go into a deep downturn. So I think it would probably take a couple years, maybe with the downturn and ultimately the cutting back of some production, that oil prices would probably be mostly down in 2015, sharply down in 2015, still weak in 2016, and then bounce back by 2017 would be a rough scenario. But I think oil is going to be between $10 and $80 for the next several years. I don't think it gets above 80, and it may not even get back to there. And I think it gets as low as 10 to 20 at some point. So oil is going to stay in this range where fracking just doesn't cut it. Once these present wells are tapped out, they're not going to be drilling new ones. And the yield on the junk bonds for these high energy companies is already spiking and will spike much more. So they're not going to have cheap money anymore. The government made that a temporary phenomenon, but now the bubble's going to defeat itself, like all bubbles always defeat themselves. And the thing I have to stress to people that they just don't get, because we are dumb at bubbles, is bubbles always burst. Always, always, always. There are no exceptions in history, and everybody's acting like the government can keep this bubble from bursting, and they really are trying. But their own efforts, this cheap money, has caused things to bubble up, all types of financial assets, oil, commodities, real estate, everything, and it's just going to crash again. It can do nothing else.
Well, how long can our government bubble last with the consistent growth of debt?
Yeah, well, you know, that's what they're doing. We only have more debt now. Government, private debt's gone down a little bit. Government's gone up dramatically. The same thing in Japan, and much more dramatically. They just keep doing it until the bubbles burst or until something triggers a crisis. And again, it does. All it took, I keep reminding people, in 2008, a subprime crisis concentrated in just four states in the U.S., California, Arizona, Nevada, and Florida, caused a whole global financial crisis and collapse of stocks and a debt crisis and commodities and real estate. I mean, four states. That's all it took to trigger it. Why? Because we had 2 to 3 times the amount of debt relative to GDP than we had in 1929 at the top of the bubble. We are the greatest bubble in modern history, and it is the most global. And worse than that, a big part of it was real estate. And real estate gets very illiquid and has high mortgages against it. So you get a much worse downturn when real estate is at the center of it. Back in the roaring 20s and early 30s, it wasn't residential real estate. It was farm real estate and farm equipment. We had a tractor bubble. And so farmers borrowed incredibly. And so when the Great Depression hit, it was small banks lending to farmers that went under, not the big money center banks. Now it's the big money center banks. You know, all these derivatives, all these asset-backed securities, all this lending against real estate, you know, with no money down, they're the ones that are going to get hit. I'd rather have the smaller banks are going to survive better. But one way or the other, bubbles always burst, and debt bubbles are always followed by deflation. That's why it's not even an issue to me. You look at history, there's no exceptions on this either, except for some third world banana republics, that when you have a debt bubble and it finally unwinds and that debt gets restructured and written down, which it needs to be long-term and is good for the economy long-term, you get a period of deflation because dollars are disappearing. Dollars created in the bubble, and then they disappear when it gets restructured. Financial assets bubble up, and then they collapse and get restructured to lower price levels. That's destroying money as well. So we're going to see a lot of money destroyed. That gives deflation instead of inflation. If you don't understand that, you could be 100% right, understanding that there's a debt crisis and something's going to go wrong in the next so many years. But you'll be, if you're investing for inflation, as Peter Schiff and most experts say who are warning about this, you're going to lose money like you would have in 2008. Gold's going to go down. Silver's going to go down. Commodities going to go down. Real estate, all these hard assets they tell you to buy are going to go down like they did in 2008, and you're going to lose money. You need to be in the U.S. dollar versus other currencies. You need to be in cash and safe investments. So when everything deflates, you get to walk in with cash and buy stuff at 20, 30, 40 cents on the dollar. That's how you make money in deflation, not by chasing yield, not by being in any financial asset except the highest quality bonds.
Well, Harry, I had a question here for you, but I think you've just kind of answered it. You know, I was talking over the weekend with some friends that don't have an insignificant amount of investments, and they're kind of seeing the downturn coming, or as you know, some more than others, and they're running to gold. And one fella said, "You know, I'm all in gold," and I kind of snickered, and he said, "No, really, I'm all in gold and gold-backed securities and stuff." And so I guess my question was, you know, what's the reasoning, you know, behind the drop in gold? I think the conventional wisdom in the past has been, well, when things get bad, run to gold. So you know, and you've kind of answered that, but what's maybe you could more specifically address, you know, how is gold going to get hammered in this in the next couple years?
Well, a couple things I'll say about that. If you look at gold long term and adjust for inflation, it is not an appreciating asset, and neither is real estate long term. Now, the difference is you can earn rent from real estate, or you can substitute, you know, for your mortgage and get a yield. Gold has no yield and no appreciation except for inflation, and that's why it did so well in the 1970s. That was the greatest inflation in modern history. Gold and silver were two of the best investments you could possibly have, but this is deflation. Gold is not it is an inflation hedge. It's not a deflation hedge. In fact, it's only doing poorly. And part of what happens is gold was going up for a while into 2011 and hit $1,934 because what gold investors saw is, hey, governments are printing money, and that's going to cause inflation, and gold likes inflation. Well, what caused gold to collapse in early 2013 and ever since is the Japan tripled its QE. The U.S. came up with QE3 and QE3 plus. Everybody stepped up QE, and inflation fell from 3% to 1%. And people finally started scratching their heads and saying, oops, maybe we're not going to get high inflation, and then gold dropped. And insane. I mean, everybody, every government in the world is printing money, including Switzerland, including Sweden. Everybody's doing this to fight deflation. Deflation is the trend. Therefore, you have to position yourself in investments that do well in deflation. And in deflation, cash and cash flow is king. Cash will be worth more. Cash flow will be worth more when everything resets. It's like a waterfall going down and falling to a new permanent lower level. We need to erase this bubble that primarily was created between 2000 and 2008. Our total debt more than doubled. Private debt went from $20 trillion to $42 trillion in just 8 years. Government debt went from 5 to 10. That's just federal. I mean, we more than doubled our debt of all history in 8 years. That's called a bubble. And if you don't erase that bubble, this debt will weigh us down like it's weighing down Japan. These high financial assets mean the next generation has no chance of really affording a good home, no chance of investing long-term for retirement because assets are so overpriced. We need everything to come down back to normal, and that is always painful. Because you get deflation, and that's called in history depressions. Depressions are deflationary economic contractions. What we saw in the 70s was an inflationary contraction, high inflation, increasing recessions. That is totally different from what we saw in the 1930s. And in inflation, emerging markets did well. Japan was in a positive cycle when the rest of the world wasn't. Now they're opposite. Commodities did well. Gold and silver did well. Real estate did well. None of those will do well in a deflationary environment. And that's what, like you say, people saying, well, I better buy something solid like gold. I better buy hard assets and commodities. No. And the richest people in the world, and I've heard so many people say this, I almost want to vomit, the richest people now think the one place you could never, ever, ever, ever lose money is buying the most expensive real estate in cities like London and San Francisco and New York. And that is so dead wrong if you look at history. Those areas are so bubbled up that somebody just bought, you know, in the last few years, $13,000 a square foot, you know, $120 million condo, 7,000 square foot condo. You think that can't go down? That's probably going to be worth $10 million in 5 years, from 120 or 20 million at best.
Harry, speaking of real estate, how will the deflationary cycle affect, certainly the price of real estate? But what about residential rents or commercial rents? I mean, right now, there seems to be somewhat of a boom in rents for both multifamily and individuals, but I think probably a drop in rents for commercial type space. Just how does that all work when the crash comes again?
Well, you know, we've been warning about this. I mean, when home prices crash and lending standards get very, very tight, as they did in 2008 and 2009 for a while, then. You know, people, the younger generation prefers to rent rather than own. So rents tend to actually trend up a bit. The slow economy works against them, but the demand for rentals over owning is more in its favor. And also demographics. We look, you know, people buy real estate, different types of real estate at different times in their life. The echo boom is in a positive rental cycle into 2017 or so, while the baby boomers are falling in their demand for houses, and the next generation is not rising that much yet. So demographics favor rentals for the next several years, and the economy will favor rentals. And when house prices contract, I mean, that's where banks get in trouble. That's where people get underwater. They get locked in their homes. They either have to, you know, hand the keys to the bank, or they're just stuck in there. They can't move. They can't refinance. They can't do anything. So this is, it's devastating for people sitting in real estate, because unlike stocks or commodities, hey, if I want to sell my gold and I realize I'm wrong, I can do it Monday morning, you know, when the market's open, like that, at whatever price. Real estate, a lot of times you just can't sell it. It just becomes incredibly illiquid. So I've been trying to talk people out of real estate for years. When I sold my house in Miami, when I moved to Tampa in October 2005, right at the top of the market, we were warning the housing bubble was peaking there in our newsletter. And I've been renting ever since, but I can't talk hardly anybody into selling real estate. Maybe not your primary home, but people have vacation homes or they have investment properties. Real estate is one of the worst places to be, and we show bubbles tend to erase themselves before they bottom out or go a little lower. Housing has to fall 40% after this mild rebound in recent years, has to fall 40% from here on average in the U.S. just to erase the bubble that started in January of 2000, just back to there. And so real estate, I think the next downturn is going to be more severe for real estate than the one that hit between 2006 and 2012.
Wow. So you think then across the board, real estate's going to probably go down another 10 to 20% or more?
No, I'd say 40% from here.
Wow.
40% from here. You know, the real estate's not as high as it was in most cities in 2005, 2006, but it has to fall a good bit lower. Now, here's the real thing, though. Real estate is extremely different across the country and around the world. The more it bubbles up, like in San Francisco or Miami or New York, the more it's going to crash when it crashes. The less it bubbles up, like, you know, in Kansas City or somewhere, you know, in the middle of the country, or Atlanta, the less it'll go down. One of the places I'm worried about, the last time around I told people, look, Texas isn't going to be so bad because Texas didn't bubble up that much, into 2005 or 2006. But now it has Texas has been so attractive, and partially because of this fracking boom, Dallas and Houston, cities like that, have gone to new highs. One of few cities that have gone to new highs. So now they're more overvalued than they were in 2005 and 6. And now you get this fracking collapse. People forget that in 1986, when the rest of the country was booming, Texas had a huge oil collapse, a huge real estate collapse, and recession. So I think Texas this time is going to be someplace that's going to get hit in the middle of the country. But I think the middle of the country between the Allegheny Mountains and the Rocky Mountains, that's where real estate bubbled the least and where they'll be most. But all the coast and the Rockies and now in Texas are in danger of major real estate declines, and that's going to kill the banks, and it's going to kill, you know, people who own real estate.
Well, here in the Northwest, you know, if you have a if you take the average income and you have 40% of that go to your principal residence, that'll get you just about an 80s ranch house piece of junk that needs to be fixed up. I mean, it just doesn't make sense here, in my opinion.
It doesn't. I remember before I moved to Florida in 2002, I was in California, and I'm sitting there, you know, helping my stepdaughter look for a house in Oakland. And, I mean, the little shoebox, a crappy house, was $800,000. Well, it's probably $1 million now. How can a couple buy a starter home in that price range in places like California or Seattle or Vancouver? Vancouver is horrible. I mean, $1 million gets you nothing in Vancouver. So, yes, how can anybody think that long-term it's good for our country, it's good for business, good for consumers to have real estate at 2 to 3 times the price it is normally? It's not good. It's only good for people who are sitting in real estate and getting appreciation, something for nothing. Again, what I said earlier, Robert Shiller did this many years ago. If you take real estate, residential real estate in the United States, he went all the way back to 1890 or something, adjusted for inflation, adjusted for the size of the house, which has gotten much bigger on average, and it doesn't go up. Adjusted for inflation, housing is not an appreciating asset. We learned this in Monopoly and forgot it. You don't get paid for appreciation when you buy Boardwalk. You get paid when somebody lands on it and has to pay rent. Housing is for renting or for owning to save rent. So people totally don't understand real estate, and they totally don't understand gold. Those are two investments I cannot talk people out of because they're emotionally tied to it. And worse than that, they got total blinders on. If you look historically, both of these are non-appreciating assets when you adjust for inflation. Stocks, when you adjust for inflation, on the other hand, earn 7% over the last century. That stocks are an appreciating asset. It's just they're overvalued now, and they're going to have to crash before they'll be a good investment again. But when real estate crashes, I'm going to tell people, except for some of the extreme bargains, hey, buy only if you're going to live there long term, or buy if you can rent it out at positive cash flow. Don't buy real estate because you think it's going to go roaring back to the 2006 highs. We are not going to see real estate go back to those highs for decades, if ever, especially with slowing demographics, decades out. Japan's real estate, and I've been reminding people of this because it peaked in 1991, has been down 60% and has never really bounced significantly 23 years later. And their demographics just get worse and worse. More old people dying. And guess what old people are? They are sellers. Less young people coming along to buy. Real estate will never be the same. Real estate may not appreciate for the rest of our lifetimes in most areas.
We know, Harry, you're exactly right, because one of the problems I run into every day as a financial advisor is talking to people, and I run into people who have stuck all this money into gold, and I try to tell them, you got to read this book. I give them your book, and I say, you got to read this book, because you are setting yourself up for a gigantic failure. And there's no recovery. If you go through that and gold tanks like you're thinking it's going to tank, there's not going to be recovery for a long time. And you can't eat gold.
Yeah, you can't eat gold. You can't rent it out. It costs, if anything, to store. It's heavy. It's a useless asset except for jewelry and some industrial uses. And anybody thinks that gold can be the backing for the money supply in an information world, where information's growing far faster than natural resources and will for as far as the eye can see, all the gold in the world will fit in an Olympic-sized swimming pool. How could that be the base for the money? Back in the 1800s or in the time of Rome, there was enough gold to back the money supply or be the base of it. It's not. We need standards. We can't just let central banks print money anytime they want. That's why we're in so much trouble and such a bubble. But gold is not going to ever be the money supply again. It may be temporarily for some countries, but it's not going to be. My forecast that gold will crash in the next year or two and hit $700, and then ultimately before this whole winter season or deflation crisis is over 6, 7, 8 years from now, it'll probably hit 250, 400 in that range. So gold's already down 40% in the last few years. Silver is down like 60-some percent, falling from 49 to 15. And by the way, Chuck knows this, we told people right when silver hit its top of $49, sell gold and silver. We're retesting the highs in silver all the way back to the 80 bubble. This is strong resistance. If you're ever going to sell, sell now. And now silver's at $15 to $16 from $49. I mean, so anybody who's not questioning gold and silver has to have blinders on.
Yeah, and that's the problem. People get emotionally attached to their investment, like gold and silver, and they lose all logic to what's
going
on. Well,
they say, you know, gold and silver, that's the real money. You know how much it would cost us if we had all our money in gold and silver, how much that would cost? The currency would cost as much or more than the products we're buying. That's not effective money. Money just needs to be built on a solid foundation with governments that are trustworthy and don't manipulate the money supply like governments are doing today. That's why we're going to have this deflationary collapse and bubble collapse. Governments have manipulated the economy into growing faster than they should, into assets going up higher than they should. Debt went up 2.5 times GDP from 1983 to 2008. How can that ever be sustainable? And economists would sit there in 2007-08 and say, oh, you know, we don't have a debt problem. We can afford this. You got to be crazy. I mean, that is absolute misunderstanding of the economy. Governments should have rules for the economy and have solid money so the free markets can work and go through what they have to go through to grow and rebalance. Governments have taken over the economy saying we're going to grow at 3%, damn it. We're going to have 2% inflation forever, damn it. And the stock market's going to always go up and never go down, and we're never going to have a recession again. That is like saying we don't trust or respect or like at all the very free market capitalist system since the late 1700s that has made us and many countries unbelievably rich. We're killing the golden goose with this. No, we got to take over the economy, and we can never have any pain, never any adjustments. You know, these central bankers who've never had sex, never run a business, are trying to dictate and run our economy. This is the worst thing I've ever seen in economic history. The worst, except for the South Seas and Mississippi bubble in the early 1700s. That was the biggest bubble burst in history. This will probably be the second biggest bubble burst.
Well, you know, one of the things that's happened recently, we've discussed this before with you on the air, and I was absolutely shocked the other day to read that some of the national companies like Microsoft are going to accept Bitcoin. And I hear people saying to me, I mean, I've had people call my office say, I'm going to invest in Bitcoin because if you're right and the market crashes, I'm going to have my Bitcoin. And who are they
you look at the chart, it looks like every other bubble. Why would I buy a Bitcoin bubble? Don't you think that would crash if we have a deflationary crash? I think so.
Yeah, I'd tell them, look, if you're investing in Bitcoin or you're going to invest in gold or silver, you better just be prepared to write it down for a long time.
Well, you know, that's another thing, Chuck. I mean, Carl, how can you have something as a base for money, whether it be gold or silver or Bitcoin, when they bubble up and down? Gold, silver is one of the most volatile. Silver and oil are two of the most volatile commodities. You know, how could silver or gold? Gold can be $1,800 one day and you know, $250 5 years later. How can that be the basis for money when it varies that much? Bitcoin varies all over the place. I don't understand the Bitcoin thing at all. I think Bitcoin may be the beginning of a new approach to currency in some way, but the way it is now, this is not going to be our currency.
Yeah, I agree 100%. Carl, did you have one more question?
Well, yeah, I was just going to say that in light of all of this, it must be kind of frustrating because you've proven yourself to be accurate on so many things, and you keep hearing the you know, Pollyanna sort of stories. And I would just caught a little snippet here this morning about President Obama's speech, and he said one of his quotes, the quote that I heard was, "By every metric, we're better off." And I thought, I bet you Harry doesn't agree with that. So anyway, just thought.
Well, you know, basically, all things considered, I mean, the everyday person isn't doing much better, but they're doing better than if we'd have gone into depression. The rich are doing better than ever because they've pumped up financial assets to even higher levels. And these people, the top 10%, own over 90% of the financial assets in the country. So we are better in ways, but the problem is the way we got there is something for nothing. They just printed, you know, $4 trillion. If you look at all the central banks around the world, they calculated recently, $14 trillion, the size almost of the entire U.S. economy, was just created out of thin air, just pulled out of thin air, thrown in the economy to make up for the downturn. We're just filling the downturn, the deflationary crisis, with free money. Now, unless I missed something growing up and missed something from studying history, I have tended to find that something for nothing is not a good strategy. You always get your ass kicked down the road when you go for that. So this is crazy. So we are better off in a lot of ways, and we avoided what would have been another Great Depression, but you can't avoid that forever. And Japan's only done it as a single country because they had their bust when everybody else was booming, and they've done it at the expense of zero growth, zero inflation. They're in a coma economy. I cover that in Chapter 2 of the Demographic Cliff, that the price for them staving off the debt crisis and having banks fail and all this sort of stuff has been they'll never grow again, and eventually they'll die because they're aging. But despite that, their stocks have been down 80% at the bottom early 2009, and real estate's been down 60%, commercial down 80%, and never bounced. So they're going nowhere. So if you don't take your medicine, if you don't let these bubbles burst and let the economy rebalance itself, which the free market system will do faster than you can blink your eye. I mean, and we deflated the whole balloon between 1930 and 33, just 3 or 4 years, and then we did nothing but grow after that. The economy knows how to rebalance itself, just like your system knows how to get rid of bad sushi, you know, and it does it as quickly as possible. It doesn't do it slowly. It takes the pain and gets the bad stuff out of your system, and that's what the economy was starting to do in 2008. Financial assets were deflating. Banks were getting in trouble. Loans were failing. That's how you clear out the system. It's like vomiting or diarrhea or whatever you want to call it. That's what the body does because it's the smart thing to do when you have an imbalance. Don't keep the imbalance in your system. You'll just get sicker. So, yes, we are better off by these metrics. We are more in debt. We have bigger bubbles now around the world, and so we're sicker. So we're not better off if you look at the whole picture. But you just look at GDP and things like that, yeah, we're a little better off with – how could you not be better off when somebody dumps $4 trillion of free money in the economy?
Yeah, absolutely. But the problem is by kicking that proverbial can down the road, the end result is when we get that illness, it's going to be a hell of a lot worse than it would have been if we'd have just taken our medicine back in 08.
Exactly. There's no question about that. All you got to do is the typical addiction cycle. Somebody's taking drugs. They get addicted. They have to take more and more to keep getting high. It causes them to get sicker and sicker, but they keep taking more until they collapse. And the longer you keep taking more, the longer you extend that cycle rather than going to detox or whatever, the worse your come down is going to be. And some people just literally die of it, you know. So, there's no question that when we do have this crisis, it's going to be worse than it would have been. And, in fact, I would say we would have been largely over this crisis by 2012 if we'd have just let it happen. It would have been like the Depression. The worst stuff would have come out in a few years, and we would have much lower debt, much more affordable real estate for the next generation, and we'd be ready to grow again. But nope, we don't want to take our medicine.
Well, listen,
pain, none, zero. No pain, no gain. Yeah. That's life.
Listen, we really appreciate your time you spent with us, and we wish you and your family a very Merry Christmas and a happy holiday, and hopefully you're going to get some time off to kind of relax during the holidays, and give our best to Rodney and Lance and all your staff. They do a great job down there, and we appreciate your time with us here today, and I hope you enjoy the rest of your Saturday. We've taken up a lot of your time, and we really appreciate it.
Okay, thanks, Chuck. Thanks,
Harry. You bet. And by the way, for you listeners out there, we are now on iTunes. We're also on Apple, and you can hear our show anytime of the day or night. You can go on there and catch our program and catch previous programs, and especially if you, because this 40 minutes went really quick, if you want to go back some of the things you might have missed and listen to, you can go back and listen to those. We're going to take a quick break and come right back with we'll let Carl come back into the fire pan here after Harry Dent, but we'll come back with a few little comments and Carl's comments, and then we'll talk to the tax investigator. You're listening to Investing Simplified.
Price Financial Group, wealth management. We do investing simplified.
The time to stop working is approaching, or maybe it's already arrived. CDs and money markets are paying only fractions of a point. How secure do you feel about retiring right now? Call Chuck Price. He's located right here in Portland, and he can show you how to increase your Social Security up to 67% using specific program rules and the file and suspend strategy. Chuck specializes in working with people who are either retired or are close to retiring, and he focuses on how to never run out of money during retirement. Do this today. Schedule a free 20-minute retirement plan phone consultation or schedule an appointment with Chuck himself. Call 503-253-3000. That's 503-253-3000. Chuck Price at Price Financial Group Wealth Management. On the web at pfgwm.com.
When your legal rights and responsibilities are involved, you need attorneys you can trust. The attorneys at the Warren Allen Law Firm offer you solid legal advice and exceptional service. We practice in nearly all areas of law. We can help you with your legal needs, including wills, trusts, probate, contracts, real estate, construction, landlord rights, business, personal injury, divorce, bankruptcy, and civil litigation. The Warren Allen Law Firm has represented individuals and businesses for over three decades, and its nine attorneys have more than 200 years of combined experience practicing law. By combining experience and knowledge with individualized attention and prompt service, Warren Allen is the law firm to rely on when you are in need of legal representation. We are conveniently located at 850 Northeast 122nd Avenue near the I-205 and I-84 interchange. I'm Carl Jepson, partner with the Warren Allen Law Firm, and I invite you to contact us at 503-255-8795 or on the web at warrenallen.com.
Got a legal question? Coming up is Carl Jepson, estate planning attorney and partner of the Warren Allen Law Firm, with Carl's comments. You can call Carl at 503-417-7626. That's 503-417-7626. Here's Carl Jepson.
All right, send lawyers, guns, and money.
Well, back to Investing Simplified, and it's always difficult to follow Harry Dent, so I'm going to exhort everyone in the audience to give us a call to see if you can stump us on some question that you have burning in your mind. So you have a few minutes left, and we're at our regular numbers, which are
503-417-7626 and 800-990-0750.
Thank you.
Wow, Kevin's the CPA
right on the book.
Saved
that,
the day.
Picked that up right away. I didn't have that one. I usually have it written down. And anyway, so please give us a call, because we've had a lot to hear from Harry, and it'd be good to do that, to call us and have a little impromptu discussion with you, even if you just want to comment a little bit. But other than that, here's Carl's comments. May the miracle of Christmas give you joy and peace for the rest of your days.
I love it.
Period.
I love it.
How's that?
Well, you know, speaking about that, we all certainly want to wish all of our listeners a very Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year, and hope that 2014 has been great for you, but I think 2015 is going to be even better. And hopefully, with all the stuff that Harry did had to say, we'll make it a very good year anyway.
Yeah, I think maybe what we should try to do, I think we should invest in a movie that kind of shows the demographic cliff, sort of. You know, one of those apocalyptic movies, you know?
Well, it would be, too.
Throw in a little North Korea there, and it'll all be real interesting then.
Well, yeah, you know, North Korea kind of gets covered over by an ice age or something.
Oh, yeah. Something like that, yes.
Well, that could work. That could work. You'd make a lot of people happy that way.
So I gathered from Harry's comments that we need to get off our binge of gold and real estate, have a financial version of the flu with symptoms of vomiting and diarrhea, and get into a cash position, I guess, or conservative positions.
Well, one of the things we have been talking about, and I've been talking to my clients for quite a while here about it, and nobody can predict exactly when this is going to happen. And you never hear Harry say this is going to happen, but one of the indicators he does mention in his book is that we're going to hit the high highs again, and we just broke through those again. And so we have hit those high highs, and that means that any time after that, we could see the step back in the market or the correction in the market. And there's a lot of things going on in the economy worldwide that causes a lot of concerns. But I think you need to be prepared. We've been telling people in our 401ks and in our management of their retirement plans is that at this point in time, we're very, very conservative. When you're very conservative, that doesn't mean you're going to always make money either, because the income market adjusts too, and bonds, bonds are going to fluctuate too, especially when the government artificially pushes the rates down and are holding the rates down by printing money. They're still holding those 10-year treasuries. I mean, you look at that 10-year treasury rate, Kevin, 2.1. I mean, that is historically dirt cheap. And so where do you go? You got to be really careful right now. And I tell clients, look, if you want to take a risk right now, you are really rolling the dice. So just beware. But, Carl, you know, one of the great things about the law is it gets to change every year, too, just kind of like taxes, because you have new court decisions, new federal and state court decisions that determine what happens in cases that you work on.
You know, that's an interesting comment, Chuck, because actually every now and then I reflect on this. I've been a lawyer since 1974, and back in 1974, the Oregon statutes occupied 3 or 4 volumes, and that occupied about 18 inches on a bookshelf. And now there are like 22 books, and it you know, the length of it is about, 2.5 feet, 3 feet. And so it's pretty amazing. And that's just the statutes. That doesn't even consider the Oregon regulations, which are amazing. And then if you add to that the federal stuff, and you know how big the tax code has grown since you started being a CPA there, Kevin. It's just an amazing. And then the regulations that go with it are just astonishing. So
that's just the source code you're talking about, not to mention all the cases and rulings and interpretations and advice memorandums and
it is really, and it's very, very difficult to keep up on everything, and that's why all of us here recommend people to, you know, if you're going to find an expert that knows something about what you're doing, because there are people who could spend their life just learning about estate tax, yeah. And yet you really have to know something else beyond estate tax to make it work, because that they are all interrelated.
They do. You know, it's interesting. We brought up bitcoins earlier. Part of my the tax investigator here was I was going to bring to our listeners' attention those who are involved in bitcoins. This year, the IRS did make a ruling on how that's going to be treated, and they are calling it anything but a currency. This is and it's called a virtual currency because you are bartering goods and services with this, but they are not treating it as a currency. It is a capital asset and or property in exchange for goods.
So they're treating it as a cash transaction, basically?
Yes, a transaction.
Kind of like gold, because gold used to be capital gain, but now it's ordinary income.
Right. And so this is, it depends on how you're going to be using it. You know, if you're in the business of mining bitcoins and you do this every day, you're probably self-employed and you're going to owe self-employment tax on it. If you are just accumulating 100 bitcoins to see what it's going to do in the future, well, now you probably have a capital asset. So, I mean, there's going to be numerous ways, but it's not going to be a currency. And if you exchange it for goods and services, it potentially could be traded as bartering income, and those rules would apply. So it's an interesting beast right now, but it's don't think you can sneak money into bitcoins and have some gain and not pay tax on it, because this has a, I don't want to call it a paper trail, but this has a digital trail a mile long, and they can track bitcoins very easily on public records through the blockchain. So know that it's well looked at.
No, I remember there was a time when bartering was a really big deal, and exchanging service or product for service. And, kind of wink, wink, we don't have to pay any taxes on it. And the IRS really frowned on that. I really know that most people, I think, in regular businesses have been very, very reluctant to do that, because there's a real problem with questions of valuation and how much it's worth versus what you get. And, certainly there are times when people, trade services and things like that, but maybe they're on the open market. Are they really that much, or are you really getting a whole lot of income for nothing? And like Harry says, when you get free money, it's probably not a good thing down the road.
Yeah, and I think the biggest thing that he said, and he's been saying to us, throughout this last year being on our show with us, is about the fact that we've prolonged this bubble. We've made the bubble bigger. It's not gotten smaller. It's gotten bigger. And so the recovery time is going to be longer. And that's what people have to understand. When you have bubbles pop, the recovery time is critical, because that's the time you're playing catch-up. And, Kevin, how does somebody get a hold of you if they want to talk to you during the week or before tax season?
We are at BakerColson.com, and we're located at 2414 Northeast Division, and our phone number is 503-666-5569.
And on the web at?
BakerColson.com.
Okay, and they could email you at Kevin@BakerColson?
Yes, Kevin, or, K-E-V-E-N, yes, at okay. BakerColson.com. No I in Kevin.
Okay.
Yes.
I miss that every now and then. Carl Jepson, warrenallen.com, and my email would be Jepson, J-E-P-S-E-N, at warrenallen.com, and the telephone number is 503-255-8795, and we are very conveniently located at 850 Northeast 122nd, just off 205 and just north of Gleason.
Well, we're at pfgwm.com, and you can go on that site, and you can sign up for Harry Dent's newsletter at that site, or you can go to hsdent.com as well and sign up for that, or harrydent.com, either one. And we're at 555 Southeast 99th Avenue, Suite 103 in Portland, Oregon. But again, if you go on our web, we have an excellent presentation on there about Social Security. We also have one on there on about investing, and also one on there about structured certificates of deposit. If you're one of those people who want to have guaranteed FDIC-insured investment, we have one on there that you can take a look at. But we appreciate it. We wish you all a very Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year. And actually, we will be back with one more show at the end of the year, and that'll be our year-end in review. And we'll have a fun time talking about the year in review. So that you're listening to Investing Simplified, have a great weekend. And we still got about a couple minutes, so we got a little time. Kevin, did you have a comment?
I did. I was going to ask you, with year end planning coming down the road here, do many of your clients, for tax purposes or other purposes, have maybe in the past when you were structured differently as a broker? Have standing orders in how they wanted their securities sold. In other words, I want all of my highest end stocks sold first. So when I want to sell 100 shares of Nike, I want my highest basis sold first. Or because typically it's first in, first out, unless you make an election.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's one of the things that people do when they put in stop losses on their stock. And at year end, especially with the market moving up like it is, this would be a great time to be doing that and putting a stop loss in on that stock. And typically, they're going to do it based on the cost basis of the stock and how much capital gain they want to take. Because, as you know, and this is really important for the wash sale. The wash sale means when you sell a stock, how long does it be till you turn around and buy it again? Well, that only affects if you have a tax loss, not if you have a capital gain. So it's a great time to be taking capital gains because you can turn right around and buy that stock again. So, yeah, absolutely. People do that and tend to. They should do that. If they're doing any tax planning, they're doing that.
That's true. Absolutely. And you mentioned capital gains. I'll just shoot a little flare up here for year-end listeners who have mutual funds. Know that mutual funds have recognized a lot of capital gains in the fund this year, and they're going to be passing the capital gains out on your 1099s and such. So just know you'll probably be in a higher income situation than prior years. It's been a big year for capital gains.
Well, that's one of the things, Kevin, that we always talk to clients about, too. When you buy a mutual fund, a lot of people talk about mutual funds are always deferred earnings because it's kind of growing. They kind of compare it to like an annuity or an IRA. That really isn't the case because those companies are not stupid. If they have a great year, they're gonna liquidate off and they're gonna sell those capital gains and they're gonna pass them on to the investor, and that happens every single year.
Yeah.
That's why in 2008, when the market crashed, a lot of people got hit with capital gains on portfolios they actually had a negative return on. You remember that? But they had capital gains, and I know we had a lot of clients who said, "Oh man, what happened? I got hit with all this capital gain at the year end, but my portfolio's down from what it was." That's how it works. Well, listen, we will be back with Investing Simplified next Saturday. Hope you have a great Christmas, and we will be back next week with Investing Simplified.
Price Financial Group, Wealth Management. Price Financial Group, Wealth Management. Investing Simplified. Price Financial Group, Wealth Management. Price Financial Group, Wealth Management.